This talk was given by Jeffrey Shugan Arnold Roshi at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugan Roshi is the abbot of the monastery and the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
So a couple of weeks ago, we first started with the retreats. And then we last month examined the understanding. And so tonight I thought, and this is alternately translated as what I thought and my intention. And so we look at the aspects of both of those. And as I mentioned before, so these two constitute the wisdom factors of the Eightfold Path, my understanding and my thought. And we talked a little bit about why the Buddha would have begun with these two and how they lead, working together, lead to the neural factors of that speech, action, and meditative, which are the next three aspects of the Eightfold Path. So what I want to do is say a few things. We deliver from one of the sutras that speaks directly to our thought, and then making this up and explore this together. So in the Piyadasa text, he starts off this section by saying, quoting the Buddha in the Dhammapada, "Mental states have mind as their forerunner, as their chief, and of mind are they made. If one speaks or acts with a polluted mind, then suffering follows one as the wheel, the oxen's feet. All mental states have mind as their forerunner, as their chief, and of mind are they made. If one speaks or acts with a pure mind, happiness follows one as the shadow that never departs." And so here he's drawing a direct relationship between thought, mind, thought, and action, and consequence, karma. I wanted to, I just finished reading rereading a book on the Yogacara by Bill Waldron, who I enjoyed it so much upon rereading it that we contacted him, and he's going to come next winter, this coming winter, to teach on the Yogacara, which we studied a few hours ago. But in that text, he draws a very interesting, from ancient teachings, he draws out and talks about the role of speech. And thought, of course, is a sort of internal form of speech. So I just wanted to read a little bit from what he said that underlines what the Buddha said in what I just read, and is helps us to understand why right thought is so important. So in that text, Waldron says, "The conventional expressions of everyday speech, everyday thought, because they follow along, which delineate the world into discrete objects and categories, subtly condition the way in which awareness of those very objects arise. That is, the experiences of things that we see and touch are indelibly influenced by the expressions and figures of thought and speech to which we are habituated." So he's drawing he's drawing from the teachings. So the teachings on consciousness, mind, karma, thought, speech. He draw a very close, intimate, integral relationship between speech and thought and what we actually experience. How our speech is conditioned by what we see and experience, and how what we experience is conditioned by what we think and say. He goes on to say, "Mental cognitive awareness arises via the manas," those of you who are familiar with that term in terms of the eight levels of consciousness. Manas is the seventh level of consciousness, which basically is where all of the sensory input is gathered and assembles into a sense of self. So he says, mental cognitive awareness arises through the manas, conditioned by the categories and structures of thought, which enable and perhaps even constitute thinking, reflection, and analysis. So what we think influences profoundly, in a sense, creates what we experience, what we experience gives rise, influences, and conditions what we think and say. And by extension, then, how we reflect, how we examine, how we come to understand. And so looking at it, understanding this, then really helps us to appreciate the profound influence of our thoughts in terms of how we put the world together, in terms of what we experience as the world. Because thoughts are such frequent visitors, and because we become so habituated to them, they're just sort of there. They just seem to be sort of running. And when we get practicing, then that relationship begins to change as we try to examine and let them go. And that often goes through all kinds of difficult relationships that we have with our thoughts. And we begin to see their influence, but to really appreciate how profound that is, how deep that is. And so this is from a sutra in the Middle Discourses of the Buddha titled Two Kinds of Thought. And this was referred to in some of the texts we're reading. And so here the Buddha says, before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, it occurred to me, suppose that I divide my thoughts into two classes, two categories. Then I sit on one side, thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty. And I sit on the other side, thoughts of renunciation or letting go, thoughts of non-ill will, which is loving kindness, and thoughts of non-cruelty, which is compassion. So these are the two sort of classes of thoughts that he's recognizing within himself. And as often happens in these sutras where the Buddha's talking about before his enlightenment, one of the things that always impresses me is how he's sort of inviting us into his experimental stage, where he was basically guiding himself and through his practice was examining what he was seeing and then was trying to, in a sense, be his own teacher. And as he continued to work towards enlightenment. And so he goes on to say, as I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of sensual desire rose in me. So a desire that was seeking pleasure. And I understood thus, this thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. So those of you who did the retreat last weekend, right, see a direct relationship to the way he's commenting on this, or he's reporting this to us, and what we examined about mindfulness. Right? So this is alertness, right? He's in ardency because he's recognizing the quality of the thought, and he's recognizing that a thought has arisen. This leads to my own affliction and to others' affliction and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulty, and leads me away from nirvana. When I considered this leads to my own affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to others' affliction, it subsided in me. And when I considered this leads to the affliction of both, it subsided in me. When I considered this obstructs wisdom, causes difficulty, and leads away from nirvana, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, and did away with it in this way, by examining it and seeing that it would lead to his own suffering, would lead to the suffering of others, and both, and would take him, would cause problems, and would take him away, move him away from the path that he wanted to be on. And then he goes on to say how he worked in the same way with thoughts of ill will, anger and hatred, and cruelty, working with him in the same way. He says, whatever a student frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will be the inclination of their mind. That's the bent that their mind will take. If they frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of sensual desire, they have abandoned the thought of letting go to cultivate the thought of seeking pleasure, of sensual desire. So we're redirecting our attention away from release, from letting go, and giving our energy to pursuing and having that sensual desire. And then our mind inclines in that direction towards those thoughts. If we frequently think and ponder upon thoughts of ill will or hatred or cruelty, the same thing happens. He says, just as in the last month of the rainy season, in the autumn, when the crops thicken, and a cowherd would guard their cows by constantly tapping and poking on them on the side with a stick to check and curb them. Why is this? Because they know that the cowherd could be flogged or imprisoned or fined or blamed if they let the cows into the crops. And so the cowherd has to stay right there, tapping the cows. He says, so too I saw in unwholesome states danger, degradation, and defilement, and in wholesome states the blessing of renunciation and the aspect of cleansing. And so then he goes on to say that as he abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of letting go arose in him, a thought of loving kindness arose in him, a thought of compassion arose in him. And he realized these don't lead to my affliction. They don't lead to anyone else's affliction or the affliction of both. They support and strengthen wisdom. They don't cause me any difficulties, and they actually lead me towards nirvana. And as he said, and then he goes on to say, if I think and ponder upon this thought, even for a night, even for a day, or even for a night and day, I see nothing to fear from it. I don't have to be afraid of these thoughts. But then he goes on to say, but with excessive thinking, if I keep thinking about them and pondering them, I might tire my body. And when my body is tired, the mind becomes disturbed, and then the mind is disturbed, I move away from concentration. So I steadied my mind internally, quieted it, and brought it into single-mindedness, concentration. Why is that? So that my mind would not be disturbed. Okay, so he's talking about right thoughts and then how to hold them. And then he goes on to talk about thoughts of loving kindness and compassion. And then he goes on to say again, whatever we think and ponder upon, that becomes the inclination of our mind. And so too with these liberating thoughts. And then he says, just as in the last month of the hot season, when all the crops have already been brought into the villages, a cowherd can now guard their cows by staying at the root of a tree or being out in the open. They only need to be mindful that the cows are there. They don't have to stay so close, right? They don't have to be so diligent. But they still have to be alert. And he says, there was need for me only to be mindful that those states were there. I didn't have to guard them in the same way that I did those thoughts that would be more problematic. And then he goes on to say, as a result of this, energy arose in me, and unremitting mindfulness was established. My body was tranquil and untroubled, my mind concentrated and unified. The factors of enlightenment. Okay, so in this short sutra, he's really, and he goes on, but a little bit, not a lot, but he's basically laying out how we should understand right thought. And so he begins by making clear that there are these two classes of thoughts, these thoughts, two categories of thoughts that take us into very different directions, that have different consequences, that have different effects in terms of our practice and our meditation, in terms of how we interact with others, and how we then need to work with them. And so in understanding these first two aspects, right, understanding helps to uproot our delusion and enlighten it. Right thought helps us to begin to free ourselves of the mental afflictions, the kleshas, greed, anger, and delusion, pride and jealousy, those states that are particularly strong and that really can flood and sort of take over our mind and draw us in their respective directions. And so in the same way that he really is focusing on greed, anger, delusion, and then their counterparts or their sort of how we meet them or how we cultivate, what we're cultivating to shift into right thought is the other side of greed or sensual desires, he says, is letting go, renunciation. The other, ill will, all the various forms of ill will, anger, hatred, irritation, harsh judgment arise, that we, in letting go of those, then we bring forth thoughts of loving kindness, and then thoughts that are actually more destructive in nature in terms of actually wanting to do harm. Thoughts of hatred, of anger, of violence. We shift with compassion. Okay, which means we then need to look into how we work with those three streams of thought very carefully. Because one of the things he makes clear is that, how does he basically work towards letting go of each of these kinds of thought streams? He doesn't. It's not coercive. It's not suppressive. He's using right understanding. Right. He's just reflecting on each of those. In each of those kinds of thoughts, and just reflecting on what is the karma that these thoughts create? Where does this lead me? Right? When I give energy into this, that's where my mind inclines. That gets stronger. When you feed this mouth, that body gets stronger. Is that the direction I want to go in? And in that very process of analyzing that particular thought, those states begin to soften and dissolve to the point where he can let them go. And so, what's happening there? Right? What do we need to understand about that so that we can really trust this and work this way? Okay, so let me just stop there and see what your thoughts are about this. Mm-hmm.
I think in one sense it looks like self-interest. If you're analyzing, you know, the consequences of a thought and you're following it through that way, that would be one sort of quid pro quo way. But I was kind of taken, I think, in that text. One of the comments he made about right thought was that it arises out of right view. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you could say anything about that, where it's not necessarily... that there's a building of wisdom in the process of the analysis, but there's also something else that seems to be happening there if it's based on self-view, right view.
Yeah. Well, if you think of the, you know, teaching of dependent origination, that based in our delusion, which is our non-right view, our wrong view, that everything else that brings forth the universe and dukkha and grasping and what the Buddha called the whole mass of suffering arises from that wrong view, from that false view. And so what that's really pointing to is that Every action, whether we're aware of it or not, every desire, whether we're conscious of it or not, every thought, whether we see it or not, is based in a sort of a fundamental understanding of who we are, what the world is, and how all of this works. And because it's so integrated within us, and, you know, we don't see it as a view. You know, we don't necessarily see that this thought is directly connected to how I see or how I understand this. But that, because the thought is really just an expression, right, of an understanding, right? That's what thought is. It's an expression of, you know, how we think about or how we understand or, you know, feel, but feeling is based in understanding too, something. And so that's why the Buddha is working with this, you know, to move towards non-attachment, to letting it go, to renunciation. He's working with it by seeing not only he's seeing the consequence of it, right? Because that's really immediate, right? And it's not theoretical. And he can, as we can, we don't have to imagine, we don't have to, you know, work too hard to imagine because we've already done it before. We've had this thought before. We followed it before. We know what happens, right? You know, with some variation. We know what happens. And so that helps us to connect with experience, our actual lived experience, and helps to take because the desire, you know, the thought, you know, just wants to have its own kingdom. You know, it just wants to rule and have its own sort of truth. And so it doesn't, you know, it being, you know, sort of our karmic consciousness, our sort of the system of delusion, resists examination. Doesn't want us to look too closely. Just like, you know, when you're watching a play, you know, all the props and everything that's going on behind the scenes, that's all hidden. Right? They don't want you to see that because then you're going to realize, oh, this is just something they all put together, right? It sort of steals the magic of it.
So how does that shift?
How does what shift?
That thought, I mean, that intention.
Well, so let me ask you. So just looking at the way he's speaking about, you know, letting go of thoughts that are not helpful and bringing forth the right thought. So what arena, in what realm of phenomena is he working? Or how could you describe sort of, on what level are we practicing?
Well, in my own experience, it's within my mind, but it's a sense of, there's a lot of reflection on feeling, kind of the tone of... So there's a range, and it's all happening within my own body and consciousness.
Right. And in terms of, right, then because all of that is, because the thoughts also bring sensation, right? They have sensation, they have feeling with them, and that can also, they can also have emotion, or they can bring forth emotion. And so... But in terms of how we're perceiving the thoughts themselves, in this level of practice, how would you describe how we're sort of relating to the thoughts?
Well, I just had a question about this process of, you know, recognizing, say, for example, a thought of ill will towards someone. Now, if we're sitting zazen, how does that process work then? I mean, do we really want to do that while we're?
It's a good question. So again, I see you. Oh, hang on. We're not finished. you know, when we were studying the factors of enlightenment last week, so remember there was mindfulness, and then the second factor was? Investigation of dharmas, right? Examining the dharmas, right? And so... In zazen, when we're having thoughts of, you know, seeking pleasure, thoughts of, you know, anger, thoughts of cruelty, So first, you just see them, right? First, we have to recognize them. That's mindfulness. And then we just practice renunciation. We just let them go, right? Because we see that if I don't let go and these get stronger, then my mind inclines in that direction, and I'm training myself, right, to have more of those thoughts, to strengthen them, and to strengthen the view, the beliefs that underlie them. Okay, so that's the basic practice. But often, what we encounter is that we're not able to let them go, right? They're too strong. They've already taken hold. We are drawn into them, right? And to a certain degree, we do want to follow them, right? And so they have power. And so we try and let them go, but they just return. They just return. They are already in the realm of sensation. They are already in emotion. Our mind is already, you know, developing, you know, the future wonderful or the future destruction. So we're in it. And so now, How do we continue to work towards letting go, right? So this is where examining that dharma, those thoughts, can be very important, right? Because if we just keep trying to let go, as we all have seen, that just becomes suppressive. You know, the mind becomes very tight, and it doesn't work very well. If we just, you know, cave in, then they just run unabated. And so this is a way to examine them, to really just, you know, within mindfulness, to examine them. And what are we really seeing into when we look at them in this way? As we look at the consequence of this thought, just shout it out.
The feeling it brings forth, like how it affects us in an embodied way.
Well, the effect that it's going to have on us, the consequence of that thought, and on others.
Yeah.
Right? Because remember, he talked about both. And so both of those can be motivators for us. You know, so not so very long ago, somebody said something about self-interest, Taikyo. but he's also talking about our interest in others' well-being, right? And so what we're really doing is looking at the projected karma of this action. So we're not in studying this dharma, we're also examining and understanding the nature of karma. How this thought, based in an underlying view, gives rise to thoughts, words, and actions which have consequences. Are those consequences what I want, basically? Right? Which means, so we need to have a sense of what we want. We have to have a sense of what direction, what is my path, right? And so all of that is working together, and we're working it. We're drawing upon all of those things that we are developing and have gained some understanding of, so that we sort of gain a power to practice skillfully, you know, a thought stream that has a lot of power. Okay? Say okay. You can go ahead and pass the mic on to somebody else who's raising their hand.
I was thinking that the observation that you're having the thought is already a step in the right direction, because normally you just generate thoughts. Mm-hmm. You don't actually say, oh, I'm making this thought. I'm having this thought. Look at what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Look at what I'm saying. So that, in that sense, you're actually admitting to the generation of the thought, the creation of the thought. You're actually saying, I am responsible for making this thought.
Right.
And if you've had this thought a million times, then you can actually reflect on the habitual chains of the thought and how they are habituated. Like, I have this thought, then I have this thought, and you can, I mean, if you know yourself and you've seen it enough, you've seen that particular chain. And in that sense, you can question the veracity, because there's another way of looking to say, well, to not be convinced of the chain. Mm-hmm. You're just picking that particular view because of your habituated experience. It could have been another way for another person. And so what is the real veracity of this thought? Is it, you know, we're so convinced that it's validated, right, because we're having a perception, but exactly, it's not particularly so. So those are ways to interrupt. Now I'm losing my chain of thought here. But, I mean, I would think that after a long time of doing this kind of process, if you wander in zazen, this is natural to normal kind of thing, to actually slow down and look how your mind creates these particular things that get us into deeper trouble. And therefore, you can start to untangle and release the kind of clinging that we automatically do and not believe it so much.
Yeah, because every part of that, what you just spoke of, is you're developing your inclination of mind to notice the thought, to have that mindfulness, to stop, right? Because again, the stream, you know, it's just like a river that's coming by and we fall in. And so what we're trying to do is actually interrupt, you know, that stream. And that's what mindfulness helps us to do. And so we're strengthening that capacity to do that. And then in these instances where it's too strong to just simply release, we're deliberately and consciously examining that dharma. And in these particular ways, right, this is what the Buddha realized was helpful. And then all of this becomes more and more natural and integrated and light. And so it's less and less something we have to remember to do, that it's just becomes, and it also becomes less and less necessary to do it, right? Because as we're doing that, that whole class of thoughts and everything goes along with them are calming, right? Because as you said, we're not strengthening those inclinations. Hang on a second. There was something that I thought of while you were speaking. That escaped me. Come back. Go.
In the process of creating these habits of wholesome thought and weakening the habit of unwholesome thought, it seems to me that beyond just the process of right understanding, which is a very deep form of kind of shifting these conditionings within us, it seems to me like there is a suggestion of also a form of an intentional solution. So in other traditions, you meet this in like metta meditation or meditation for cultivating compassion. Mm-hmm. And in Zen, these forms of practice, as far as I know, don't exist, or at least don't exist in the same way and form. So I was just wondering about that. Why is that?
Yeah, they do exist. I mean, they do appear in the teachings of ancient masters in this tradition. They do appear in somewhat different ways. They don't appear so much as instructions. They don't appear as sort of in a didactic, you know, presentation, because that's not really the way the Zen teachings are brought forth or were brought forth historically. But they're definitely there. And I think in when we look in various teachings, we can see, admittedly, I think, subtle and sometimes veiled references to and sort of pointing to these aspects of a cultivating, more generative practice, what you're speaking about. But again, without you know, being very explanatory about it. But putting that aside, they are, for us, they are essential, right? And we're not different from anybody else. And we're not different from all of those people practicing in the Zen tradition going back into history. So if they were practicing and freeing themselves and really realizing wisdom and compassion, they were practicing this stuff. I don't see how else it could be. And we have a very limited window into, you know, what was actually going on, and all we have is the texts, you know. In a certain sense, I think at this point it doesn't matter so much if we understand what we need to be doing. And that's also, I think, where it's helpful to realize that that it's one dharma, you know, it's one path. And so even how, you know, the Buddha speaks about this, you know, is really coming from within those original teachings and how he instructed students to practice. And so there are a lot of similarities and overlaps with how, you know, we're trained and how we're instructed to practice, and some differences, as is true with Tibetan Buddhists. You know, so we do some things in our tradition that the Buddha never did. And Tibetan Buddhists do a whole gaggle of stuff, right, that the Buddha didn't do. And so that's just part of the development and evolution, you know, that people bring to everything we do. But I think just looking at it from that perspective of, you know, it is one teaching, one essential teaching, and then looking at these various practices and emphases in different ways. Do you want to add something?
No.
So, but since you brought that up, Gal, we talked a little about how to let go of, in terms of sensual thoughts. So these are basically pleasure thinking, pleasure-based thoughts, pleasure-seeking thoughts. What about then bringing forth? So he talks about bringing forth thoughts of renunciation, which we can think of as thoughts of letting go. What is the generative thought? If you think of letting go of sensual thoughts as sort of letting go of thoughts that'll be obstructive, what are the thoughts that you bring forth that are helpful?
Mm-hmm. Just to go back real quickly, for what Gaw was saying, it is true though some of these practices in Zen are more subtle, mm-hmm. in terms of bringing about, you know, loving compassion. We have also, you have also incorporated the Metta Sutra into what we are doing. So, and it's not subtle; it's all stated right there. Mm-hmm. So perhaps because, you know, you thought that it was necessary to bring that into a larger light. So we do that now in this place, you know, and that's part of our life in a Zen Buddhist community, you know. Mm-hmm. I had a real quick kind of it's way out in left field. I don't know if this is helpful. I just thought I would, you know, I had a dream last night. And it was insane, you know. It was like Rudy, and Rudy was torn in half, and I was thinking it was just gross. And the only reason I knew it because I had to wake up to pee. So is I would not have remembered this. Mm-hmm. But I think so much of what we're talking about in terms of directing our intention, mm-hmm. and mindfulness, mm-hmm. and waking up, mm-hmm. and being aware, mm-hmm. and so much of our life is spent in sleep, mm-hmm. you know, where that's not the possibility. But I also flash that if my, during my waking hours, if my life, if I'm really living right view and right speech, I'm wondering if those kinds of dreams wouldn't be more toned down, if there would be less of that kind of of kind of spirit, and it would there'd be more ease in that because it's like where the hell was that coming from?
Yeah.
It was just.
I mean, on one level, yes, I would think so. I would sort of imagine or even expect so. And at the same time, you know, because dreams, unless you're, you know, practicing dreams or lucid dreaming, you know, they're really where your deeper consciousness, you know, has an open door. And so that those really deep underlying desires, you know, Freud said dreams are, you know, attempts to fulfill desires or attachments, you know, it can be a way for those to be, you know, to have their voice. But at the same time, and in the same vein, for us to see them, you know, and to reflect on whether there's something there that might be useful for us to. I mean, it's clearly our mind, but is there something there that might be useful for us to examine? I remembered when you talked about intention, what I thought about, which was to think of right thought, or think of right thought, of that term in right thought as, you know, the aspect of knowing and understanding that arises through thought. So it's based in understanding, but arises then through an expression that takes a particular view, a particular direction about something, because thoughts are always about something. And that right intention is more the purposeful aspect of that thought, right? What is its direction? What is its seeking? What is sort of the direction of that desire? And if we look at the underlying view underneath the thought, so if you think of a sensual desire or, you know, desire of anger or hatred, and you think and you sort of reflect back on or look at what is the underlying view, what do you see? Right? Without getting abstract and philosophical about it, what's the view that underlies? So there's something, you know, you're having a fantasy about something that's very pleasurable, right? Or you're having a fantasy about something that, you know, where you're really angry and you're acting out on that, or you're triumphing, you know, over someone, you know, in that way. What do you see as sort of part of the view that underlies that?
I'm going to get what I want.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so it's the fulfillment of that desire. And so but underneath that, what are the fundamental views underneath that?
Self and others.
Yeah, we should use the mics because the folks on. There you go.
But just self and other. I'm here and it's there, and there's this tension.
Okay, but what does that mean? Self and other, in the spirit of, you know, that strong desire that's rising in you that wants you to go with it. Can you hold the mic?
Well, it means that I'm here and it's there, and there has to be some interaction,
mm-hmm.
some motion, some mm-hmm. transaction.
Mm-hmm. And what's the position of relative importance of that self in that moment?
Primary.
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. It's the most important thing.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And so then if we think about what the Buddha is talking about, so now think about, and when you say you're primary, the self is primary, towards what end? Because the thought, the direction of that thought is purposeful, right? And towards what end?
Towards making that self safe or stronger, bigger, and better.
Right.
In relation to this other.
Right. Right. And so if the view of all of those things, stronger, safer, more loved, more famous, then, you know, that pursuit of that desire may very well bring you some of that.
For a little while.
For a little while, right? And so that's why establishing right understanding is so important. So that when we look at that view and see that or look at that thought and see the underlying view is, in that moment, this self is most important. What I want becomes more important, right? And so what the Buddha says is first reflect on, so what do I get when I pursue that? What do I actually get? And what do you get, right, when I pursue that? And what do we both get? And what effect does that have on my mind or on my meditation or on my path, right? And then as I reflect on that, I will necessarily be drawing upon my understanding, right? Which is why we start with that, so that we can reflect on and begin to establish a sort of intentionality in life, right? So it's not just I want to meditate. It's not just I want to, you know, learn how to concentrate. I want to be more productive. But it's really a whole view of this life and trying to really get very clear on what is, you know, what is the sort of overarching and underlying purpose of this life that I am having faith in and establishing. Because that then, when as that's established and becoming stronger and more established, then that process of reflecting on these thoughts and desires and where they're going is either going to be in alignment with that or it's going to come into conflict. And so then I will make a choice, you know, as to what's most important in a certain sense, you know. But that won't happen if I don't reflect on it. Reflecting on it, I may still go after that desire, right? Because in that moment, that may actually be more important to me, right? I may just... But that process itself, as Sege was saying, even if it seems weak or feeble, or it doesn't seem successful because we still get lost in something, that is changing things, right? That is creating a different inclination, a different power, in a sense.
Shugen, something that has been coming up as we've been talking is this examination of the situation becomes very important when the desire or the tension is prominent and strong. But practice, I think, at some point, would want to notice sooner. We'd want to notice when it's really weak,
yeah.
When there's not so much work to do, and it can be turned easily.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. And, you know, when we talk about right effort, that's very much a part of that. But, yeah, it's just like, you know, if you accidentally start a fire and you get to it quickly, whew, right? But if you don't, and so that's very much what we're strengthening is that very capacity.
In addition to seeing it as this demand of the self to get more, it seems another way to look at that is that the self that is understood is insufficient, and that's wrong understanding. So the desire to have a self is a reaching to have something because you don't have something.
Mm-hmm.
And it can grow in the way that Rakusan was saying.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, the experience is often really insufficiency. You know, you want to have the good thing,
yeah.
And you don't want to have the bad thing. Both is rejecting what you actually have.
Yeah.
And so for me, right understanding is letting go of that deep sense of insufficiency.
Yeah. Yeah, because if that's, you know, until that deep sense of lack, until we have sort of counter experiences, that will dominate, right? And it will seem true, you know, that there is something lacking and that it is out there until we begin to have experiences based, you know, that begin in some faith and some just good practice that leads us to have those counter experiences. So when we practice in this way, you know, remembering the seven factors, that there were all of those experiences that were very pleasurable, right? Like calm and rapture, serenity, vibrant energy, joyful energy, right? Those are very pleasurable experiences, positive experiences, and that are based, you know, as the Buddha said, we don't have to worry about those experiences, because we know that they're true, right? They're healthy. And so in the same way, we don't want to dwell in them, but that we don't have to be afraid of them. And that's where there's, you know, there's a period of time which can go on for a while where, and I think that's a lot of that struggle, is we do have faith and there's a sense of wanting to enter, to practice, you know, to use our mind in a different way, to not, you know, go the same way as before, but our actual experience of what that, of what happens when we do that is dim. You know, it's weak. It's not very strong. And so, whereas we've had a lifetime of experience of moving in those well-established habitual patterns. And so that's where one reason faith is so important. And just and this sort of process of reflection to start, to try and give it some ground. You know, Bhikkhu Bodhi said in his book, he said, in this examination, our concern must not be with what is pleasant, but with what is true. We have to be prepared and willing to discover what is true, even at the cost of our comfort or our pleasure. For true security or happiness or well-being lies on the side of truth, right? Not fleeting pleasures. I thought that was a very nice way of saying that, that we have to sort of strengthen that willingness to trust what we know to be true, even though it may not be comfortable, right? And for comfort-seeking creatures in a comfort-obsessed culture, that's not a small thing. Okay, let's look a little bit about at the two other poisons, afflictions of mind, thought streams, because how to meet them is a little, you know, according to their own kind, and so. When we have thoughts of anger, of harsh judgment, and so on, to, as the Buddha said, to, you know, if we can just let those go, if they're not that well developed yet, and that's really important, if they're not so developed, then it's easy. You know, they're very light, and we just let them go. Often, I mean, when that happens, it's done, but that doesn't what binds us. What binds us is when that's not what happens. And so going back to this examination and to try and gain faith in, you know, another way and under which examination, those energies, those thoughts and emotions will begin to soften and weaken, right? Because we're seeing there as Sege said, their lack of truthfulness, the lack of their veracity. And then we bring forth metta practice, right? And sometimes a way to do this is if that examination itself isn't sufficient, you know, that you're still sort of caught in that emotion, then to shift your attention consciously towards a metta practice So generating, bringing forth loving kindness. So in that way you could concentrate on that first of the four immeasurables. May all beings, may I and all beings know happiness, know the source of my happiness. And that you generate that sense of loving kindness, right? The felt sense of that. And so the practice of that is that you hold someone in your mind that you care about, that you easily feel that feeling of loving kindness towards. And you use that image, their image in your mind to generate that feeling of loving kindness, right? And in order for that to come forward, those thoughts and feelings of ill will are going to have to make room, right? They're going to have to subside. And so in a sense, you're taking that same energy and you're shifting it, you're inclining it into loving kindness rather than continuing to let it build into that. Let's see if there, I see some familiar hands raised, but let's see if there's anybody else who wants to. Camille?
I have a question, but it's about the previous topic. Is that okay?
Mm-hmm.
About not wanting the bad thing and wanting the good thing. It seems like, I have a hard time figuring out when that becomes like a kind of passivity, because I have, if the part of what we're trying to do is kind of watch thoughts about wanting the good thing and not wanting the bad thing come and go and come and go and come and go. I found that it's easy to err on, to then stay in situations that are not so good. Like, I don't want this job. It sucks for different reasons. And then I might stay in it for too long, or I don't want this relationship and I might stay in it too long because, not talking about any particular job, because I'm thinking, I don't want this, I want that. Mm-hmm. And I thought maybe if, it goes on for years and years, you have the same thoughts for years and years, mm-hmm. or this isn't the right job, having thoughts for a long time about it could be a way of telling, it's really not. But also there's thoughts that come for years and years and they are not true, So that doesn't, longevity of them doesn't seem like a way to tell either. I guess it's hard to know. It does seem like it's important to turn towards the good thing sometimes. Like, that's how we all ended up here, too. Mm-hmm. So I don't know.
Yeah. First, I would suggest, when we think of, is this good or bad? I think that's a bit of a precarious way to go, because that can be, in the moment that I want something, if I judge this, this isn't good. But it feels really good to me right now. And that goodness can sort of come from an externalized source. Somebody else, believes this isn't supposed to be good. Whereas what the Buddha is encouraging us to do is make it much more personal. See its direct effect on me, its direct effect on others. So it's not based on some, sort of standard of good and bad, but it's really based on the actual consequences of that. And I think your point is a good one, is that there are all kinds of thoughts that we have about things, and that when they're based in a kind of a desire, I like this and I don't like this, is that thought actually true? It may be, yes, I don't like it in this moment, but is the basis for that not liking valid, right? And so that might be a process of sort of listening to that thought and examining, what is it that I don't like? Do I see that tendency arise over and over and over wherever I go or whatever work I do? Is this a recurring pattern? Because that might be telling me something. Is it very specific to this place, this time, this work, this relationship? And do I see it connected to specific things that are causing me unhappiness or that don't feel like are not allowing it to be better or what it could be? So is there something I can do about those things? And so then I'm sort of taking the energy of those thoughts so they don't just become obsessive loops and I'm trying to address it. And then what happens? You know, can I do that? Am I successful? Does it make a difference? Do I have the power to do that? And then the answers to those questions then informs me in terms of now how do I understand those thoughts? So there may be a point at which I realize I've done everything I can and I still feel the same way. Maybe it's just not a good job, or maybe it's not the right job for me. I think this is where, as practitioners, we can get caught in, you know, sort of, in a sort of, often in a sort of just reactive way, we can just want to get out of it and get into something better and try and escape. And so, as practitioners, we're encouraged to try and, you know, hold steady, face this, not just try and get away from it, but actually turn towards it, examine it, try and use it as a way to gain that understanding and to be free. That can sometimes bind us, you know, because, I mean, I remember thinking this, you know, when I was struggling with things, when I was here, and thinking, if I just practice better, you know, if I'm just more strengthen my meditation, if I just practice, you know, I should be able to, you know, in a sense, make these feelings go away, which is kind of what I was trying to do. And sometimes that blinded me to the fact that there's something that I actually need to be doing out here, and I'm not doing it. And so I think there's a kind of a tension that we have to just be aware of and sort of practice within, and that there's not, you know, a rule for how you know. You know, we just have to, but, you know, sort of trust ourselves and try and do our, you know, due diligence to examine well. And then, you know, to be clear, you know, particularly if we're making a significant decision, to try and really be clear that we've exhausted or done as much as we could, as we feel like we could, because then, even though it might be difficult, there tends to be no regrets. Whereas if we jump too soon, and then we realize that later, then we tend to have regrets.
When we're talking about metta, I'm thinking about compassion. Mm-hmm. And personally, like I've been really struggling with, am I being truly compassionate, or is it not? You know, like this, is my heart really open? How do I cultivate that? And metta practice feels like that's like a practice, as compassion for me feels like, how do I open my heart more in a very present way? Mm-hmm.
So compassion in Buddhism means the alleviation of suffering. Mm-hmm. Loving kindness, metta, means bringing forth love and kindness and, you know, good qualities. And so compassion really is about ceasing or you know, dissolving or alleviating active suffering. And so thinking again of the four measurables, you know, to may I and all beings be free of suffering and know the source of our suffering. And so we can cultivate that by either turning towards our own suffering and reflecting on that and getting in touch with how good it feels when that's calmed or when that's released, and trying to bring forth that desire for that release from that suffering. You know, when my mom was dying and I was down in Carolina with her and with my siblings, I did these practices towards and for her. And so I would try and help her, you know, in any ways I could to provide comfort for her, you know, just in terms of if she was you know, agitated or uncomfortable or, you know, so in just a very simple way that anybody would do. But then I would also sit, and sometimes I sat with her or in her presence, you know, while she was sleeping or when she was even unconscious, because even in her unconsciousness, there were times where she seemed uncomfortable, you know, agitated. And so I would, you know, in my mind, hold her, or even just visually hold her in my mind and take in her discomfort, you know, that agitation or that fear, because sometimes I felt like what I was experiencing was her fear, and she spoke of it. And then in my mind, I would calm, hold that pain or hold that fear and just let it calm in my mind, right? And offer that to her, direct that towards her. And so so that's a way of practicing compassion, by actually turning directly towards whatever the perceived suffering is, and trying to do for that person in your mind what you would do for yourself, or to do for yourself in your mind and body what you would like to do for yourself. Okay, so it's like a releasing, a calming, and it depends. It might depend on what that experience is, you know. So if it's fear, it might be you bring forth courage and fearlessness. You know, if it's a feeling of insufficiency, you know, then it might be, you know, really sitting that sense of wholeness and completeness. If it's physical pain, right, then it might be just sitting and holding that physical pain and being peaceful with it. You know, just holding it in peace rather than, you know, in fighting. And, you know, and with her, I also sometimes would give it words. You know, it wasn't just something I was doing internally, but I might do it with her. And there were times where we did that together, where we were talking. And I was basically offering those words, you know, just as sort of a balm. And sometimes when she wasn't conscious or awake, because sometimes, you know, she was sleeping a lot towards the end, and so I would go in and just be with her while she was sleeping and speak quietly, not knowing if she was, you know, conscious or whether she was hearing this or not, but just give words to that, you know, because again, that sort of brings it out even more, makes it more felt, more real.
And so, and with all the suffering in the world and all the the so much.
Yeah.
So just sitting with that and putting that out.
Yes.
As a regular practice.
Yes.
to deal with that.
Yeah, and that's where you're using, you know, the pliancy of your mind and your mindfulness to be able to hold that, and in whatever way you can and feel moved to do that, you know. And so it might be the whole world of suffering. And so, and as you keep practicing that, I think each of us will, that will evolve, right? It both gets easier to hold that in a way that actually has strength. You know, we talked during the intensive about, I think we were talking about, you know, when you're practicing a visualization, when a student is working with a koan, when you're focusing on the breath in the beginning of practice, it's hard to hold it within our mindfulness. We keep losing it. It keeps breaking apart. The mind wanders away. We keep just losing the sensation of it. If we're trying to visualize something, the image just keeps dropping away. If you're practicing loving kindness and you're holding the image of someone in your mind, they keep falling, dissolving. You know, that's why when we talked about those objects of meditation, I'm looking at you. You weren't at the intensive, right?
No, but I'm familiar.
Yeah. So that object of meditation that we were talking about, and the Buddha said, you know, first you actually put it in front of you. It's a physical object, and you really sort of imprint it in your mind, so that then when you lower your eyes and you bring it in, now you can hold it. But still, it requires developing that mindfulness and concentration to be able to hold that without it breaking apart. And the more that happens, the stronger it is, the more the whole, this whole body and mind is developing in its capacity, not just to hold that object in its mind, but to bring forth that heartfelt wish, that heartfelt desire, because everything is getting more focused. Everything is becoming more concentrated. And so that practice then becomes that much more powerful, both in terms of its effect on us and, you know, perhaps as well as its effect on others.
So you spoke about letting go of thoughts and investigating thoughts, and in that investigation, reflecting on how a thought can be an obstacle to wisdom, mm-hmm. and how a thought can promote wisdom. Are there thoughts that are not either?
Yeah. Yeah, in terms of sensation. So when our mind comes into contact with a thought, that there's pleasant, painful, and neutral. And so there are thoughts that have very little weight, you know, very little sort of karmic influence. They can have the influence of just distractedness, right, and sort of being preoccupied. And so in that way, they're not entirely neutral in terms of their effect, but that they themselves are not, you know, they're not so much based in, you know, seeking pleasure or anger or hatred.
So sort of would just be a matter of intensity when one reflects on, like, if a thought is worthy of reflecting this way, is that just a reaction to how intense
it
comes?
You mean those more neutral thoughts?
Or thoughts in general, you know? I'm trying to think how this process would work skillfully, you know, because it seems easily just, if you're examining, reflecting on each single thought, that doesn't seem to be where this is going.
Right. And so remember, you know, we were talking about earlier that if you can, you know, if you can just release, you know, if it's easy, let it be easy. Or if it just takes a little bit of effort, let it take just a little bit of effort. But if what you're seeing in doing that, that's the strength of it is too strong, that that's not really moving you forward in terms of releasing it, then you're, you know, more deliberate in this way. And so it's not going to be every thought that arises, you know. Okay. Oh, did you want to? Because you already got the mic. Joran, are you? We're waiting for Black.
When you were first talking about the consciousness and sense, you know, the experience of being a sensation machine, you know, having sensations, I was thinking about that in terms of it's a constantly going machine of experiencing the senses and responding, and the kind of the construct in that manas part. You know, and made me think about the emphasis in the Zen school of that letting go, of that, mm-hmm. you know, of the death of it, you know, that kind of explosive, cataclysmic release.
Of the self?
Yeah. You know, and in so many of the teachings, that aspect and kind of how that relates mm-hmm. to this very mm-hmm. skillful mm-hmm. practice of working mm-hmm. with mm-hmm. that kind of interplay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, so, you know, The Zen tradition, think of the Bodhidharma's 4 points of, you know, no reliance on words and letters outside the scriptures, a direct point into the human mind and the realization of Buddhahood. And so there's this emphasis on Zazen, right, as the single most powerful lancet, right, to enter into and break through that delusion and realize self-nature. And so again, remember, you know, that this, how this developed, you know, it's like evolution. You know, it's like there's stuff going over here, there's stuff going over here, and it, you know, over time it sort of began to coalesce into what appears as a kind of coherent body of teachings and practices and so on. And that part of that development was the the experimentation, the sort of the relationship with language and linearity and discursive thought and explanation, right? Which clearly there's a strong awareness of within the Zen tradition. You know, I mean, just think of all of the ways in which that's expressed, and the emphasis on, on non-conceptual thought and breaking free of that, and the koans. And so, these early teachers who were, Shout and the Strike and these ways of trying to, precipitate, sort of startle us, sort of existentially out of that grasp of, holding on to what we know and holding on to who we are, to sort of precipitate that insight. And evidently with some success, right, in certain instances, which then became stories, and then the danger is so people then go looking for, a shout or a slap, to awaken. There are moments in, practice in any tradition of Buddhism with diligent practice in which, and even for people who have never practiced in their lives, where there are moments of awakening, right, that are very profound, that shake the heaven and earth. And those experiences then are sort of made continuous with ongoing practice and innumerable insights, that happen all along the way, which are may not be as powerful, but are all part of the path and the process of awakening. But I think that's part of the, for some people it may be part of the allure, but it's also part of the trap of looking for that kind of an experience, And often I think it means I'll work hard, but can I just have an experience which sort of takes care of the whole thing? Can I just clean the whole room at once, And that's why I think the three pillars of Zen is no longer. I think it served a purpose very, very early, but I think it no longer really is as helpful a book as it might have been in the beginning, for that very reason.
So in a sense, that the big startling one is a kind of insight, a moment of using your skillfulness about this particular thought, mm-hmm. is an insight, and that's just a cumulative practice life. Is that kind of what you're saying?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that kind of deeper insight is really, the insights that we have into self nature, into the realization moments, but if we think of insight as just seeing something that we have not seen before, that word exists in ordinary language. We learn something we never knew before, and it gives us an insight into something new. Insight in Buddhism means specifically seeing into self-nature and seeing in a way that is not based in conceptual thought. Okay, there are lots of insights that we have through just understanding, through study, through hearing something, that we now hear for the first time, then there's a sense of being changed, being affected by that. Those are real, right? But insight itself, in terms of the Dharma, has that particular meaning. Okay, maybe one more. Anybody who hasn't? Oh, Jana. Yeah, sorry.
I was curious about, so metta, my experience with practicing metta is that I'll try to cultivate some love and warmth, and it's just not quite, I'm not feeling it in an embodied way necessarily. And I still, I'm hoping and kind of asking if just even the simple act of reciting the words mm-hmm. has some power kind of in the meantime.
I think it does, yes. And particularly that, metta has been sort of accepted, its accepted translation is loving kindness. And I think that's quite I mean, that's a very evocative word, right? And I think it's fine that in engaging that practice that you may not feel or feel strongly. That's okay. It's still, you are practicing it and you're cultivating it, and that's how it changes. You know, I've talked about when I first started really engaging these aspects of practice within myself, because I really needed to. And I needed to because they were vacant in me, you know, that they weren't, I mean, they weren't vacant, but I felt like they weren't strong and strong enough. And I felt like the consequences of that on me and on others was becoming more and more clear to me and not desirable. And I remember doing those practices and sort of very much guiding myself, because I hadn't encountered a lot of these teachings yet, and feeling exactly the same way. It's like, I'm saying it, I'm doing it, I mean it, but I don't really feel it. But I just saw it, I thought exactly what I said. I thought, that's okay. I can do it, right? And not expect that there's going to be immediate response. There is a response. It may just be too subtle for me to know yet, right? So that's very important. You know, that's why, you know, trusting the Dharma, trusting our own practice and the process, because it's working on so many subtle levels that most of which we don't see, and that only become clearer over time. And so that really helps us to keep going if we trust that. So I think we should finish up just so we can take care of things. So it's going to be a couple of weeks because we have Sesshin, we have Hungry Ghost, and I've spread these out so much because in general I don't like to miss evening Zazen too much. And so on weeks when we have something else going on in the evening, I tend to skip it. But it's also nice because it'll take us into the winter. It'll be nice to keep going. Okay, so it'll be a couple of weeks. And keep reading, keep studying. We'll come to write speech next time around.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JIZOPROJECT.